Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Hi, I'm Oskar Freisinger, member of the Swiss Parliament and of the government of the Swiss Canton du Valais, and you're listening to Audrey Russo and Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. Fusion GPS's academic expert on Russia, Nellie Orr, wife of DOJ official Bruce Orr, had a hand in the Trump dossier, the Trump-Russia dossier. Who is this woman? And Bruce Baumgartner, another Fusion GPS Russian expert, was he actually a former student of Nellie Orr? Well, we're going to follow this red thread with my next guest. For my new listeners, Diana West is the author of several best-selling books, including The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. She's a former nationally syndicated conservative American columnist whose blog is one of Newsmax's 50 best conservative blogs, and it tackles controversial subjects such as the impact of Islam and the failures of counterinsurgency. Diana has contributed essays and features to numerous periodicals, including The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, and The Washington Post. She has also been a columnist for The Washington Times, Scripps Howard News Service, and United Media. And she can be read at The Daily Caller. Diana is also a popular analyst and contributor on both radio and TV. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Diana West. Welcome back, Diana.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back with you, Audrey. So much to talk about.
Oh, I know. And, well, actually, with everything that's going on, people are missing details, which I think are extremely important, and that's why I can't wait to discuss further your Red Thread series. You've done incredible research here, and, you know, I urge the listeners to absolutely go to the website after you listen here to read more, because Diana's did amazing research here. Can you give us a more in-depth look at Nellie H. Orr?
Yes, I can, because I spent a couple of weeks at least studying her, and that included her publicly available writing, some maybe a half a dozen or more academic book reviews, her CV as we could find it online, her publicly understood career movements, and later her PhD thesis. And what I found was a very clear understanding of an academic leftist, someone who literally followed in an academic movement that started becoming understood as a movement in the 1970s and 1980s, known as revisionists. Mm. You know, they're revisionists in many, many different eras, but this was a very specific period of revisionism on the campuses of America, because this was a way of normalizing the Soviet Union. And what this school basically did, and I read quite a lot into it and about it, was to soft sell the crimes of Stalin, to blame America for the Cold War, and to dispute every time possible the facts coming out of the Soviet Union, particularly in the research of the very great historian Robert Conquest, who was someone who tried very hard to quantify the crimes of Stalin. This would be going back to the Ukraine terror famine and the blood purges. These would be the cataclysms in the 1930s that killed millions and millions of people. They say upwards of 6 million people in the famine in the Ukraine. This was a product. This was a part of forced collectivization that the Bolsheviks were forcing on landholders in the Ukraine, and later in the hysteria over the purges. And what these revisionists tend to do is to either absolve Stalin of responsibility by basically blaming bureaucracy, or to, again, sort of minimize the casualties. Oh, it wasn't 6 million, it was 600,000, or other extremely huge sums of people that are still, wow, even if they were lowballing, correctly lowballing, which I don't think there's evidence they are, but even if they were, these are still huge crimes against humanity. Just generally accepting the fact that when you want an omelet, you have to break eggs. And that, of course, is the very famous chilling line from Walter Duranty, the New York Times writer who won a Pulitzer for doing the exact same thing in the 1930s and essentially dismissing the news of the terror famine. So this is essentially what they were doing 50 years later, when there was even more information about these cataclysms, and essentially this was a very cold way of justifying far-left socialist and communist views. So this is the school that Nellie Orr very clearly followed as an academic herself, coming at the end of it. She graduated from Harvard in 1983 and would get a PhD in Russian history at Stanford in 1990. So she's coming at the end. She was not one of the originators, but she is a follower, and this is very clearly understood when you see the her mentors and the kinds of books that she supports and reviews favorably and offers as guidance for students, graduate students and undergraduates in her reviews. So this is a very cut and dried process that I went through that was able to identify her as coming from this, what in the 1930s and 40s people would say the Stalinist left. So this is nothing vague or unknowable. But what I do notice is that she is continually referred to in media as simply an academic expert or a Russian scholar, which may have truth in on paper. But until you actually understand the kind of history, the social history that she follows and has herself engaged in, you do miss the importance of this when you're talking about Russia. So this becomes a very important thing to start discussing, trying to understand, trying to remember, because, Audrey, our biggest problem in trying to deal with all these things is that we, as a culture, as a society, we know nothing. Our students, our children, but ourselves, our own generation, the generation ahead of us, we know nothing. Yeah. We've been taught nothing. And this, to me, is not any kind of an accident. This was actually something that the old Soviet Union and new Russia were very intent on in terms of literally depriving the United States of America of an enemy. And this was something that their own propagandists, their own senior Soviet and Russian officials actually discussed. There's one by the name of Arbatov who very specifically discussed how with the so-called changes in Soviet Union in the 1980s, they were going to take away the United States' understanding of having an enemy. Mm-hmm. And I think by gum we can say they did that very thing, mm-hmm. along with a lot of other trends and movements. So we are actually at a point now where we do not even comprehend the past, which makes it impossible to deal with the future and certainly the present, which is our most pressing matter. So that's sort of a nutshell on Nelly.
Yeah. Could you, her dad, Richard, if I'm saying Hawk, if that's the way you mm-hmm. pronounce his name, can you tell us about him and the theory of nuclear winter? Because maybe listeners are not familiar with that.
Yes, well, I was able to examine some of her parents' work because they were both PhDs, both professors on American campuses, and their papers are archived, I believe, at University of Rhode Island. And in the archive listings, you can see, get a sense of what they were looking at. Her father was a botany professor, and certainly most of his work was in the science world. But the archive does mention his particular interests, which included very political topics, including the 1980s hot topic of nuclear winter, which, yes, most people have forgotten by now because, of course, we've spent the last 20 years talking about global warming. But back when the Reagan administration was coming into its own and very much involved in ramping up, in improving, in testing, in creating a military defense system that had fallen into such disuse and disarray and obsolescence in many ways, the propaganda wars began to push back on Reagan and his Star Wars, if you remember the deprecations of the idea of missile defense and all the rest of it. And we saw the nuclear freeze movement come to the fore and the peace movement. This was all designed to try to prevent Reagan and NATO from upgrading missile emplacements in Europe to protect against the still Soviet threat. One of these pieces was the concept of nuclear winter that became a huge deal in the early to mid-1980s. This was the theory. Carl Sagan was a leading propagator of this theory, mm-hmm. that if there was any kind of a nuclear exchange, a real nuclear exchange, the resulting dust would be so thick that it would block the sun and we would no longer be able to grow food in this nuclear winter. And it was quite a terrifying prospect. And there was even a very big ABC movie of the week on this that seemed like the entire country watched in about 1983, if I'm not mistaken. And later on, we find from a very important and reliable defector by the name of Sergei Tretyakov, he discussed this particular nuclear winter theory as being part of the panoply of disinformation that Soviet Union and then Russia, because, of course, this Tretyakov's own career spanned Soviet and Russian times, was part of a propaganda war to try to prevent Ronald Reagan from improving America's defenses. Uh-huh. And nuclear winter, according to Tretyakov, and you can read about this in Pete Early's book, Comrade J, this was something straight from the KGB, part of a panoply of KGB information, active measures called disinformation, that included the nuclear freeze movement, the peace movement in Europe, the hysteria over nuclear winter. These were all generated, and in this case, the nuclear winter, according to Tretyakov, generated inside the gigantic disinformation section of the KGB. And it becomes quite fascinating when you also realize, that typical of left-wing professors of the day, Nelly Orr's father was someone who seems to have bought into this. This was something he wrote about himself, along with many, many, I'm sure, of his peers. This was nothing unique. This was sort of where we are in terms of our academic intellectual left. So this is where she comes from, and certainly she did not break from that same wavelength.
Wow. Wow. She's it's just an interesting character that we're really
very.
We're not hearing anything, of course, except thanks to you. We're otherwise we're not hearing anything about her. We know nothing about her. You know, I want
well, it's
to.
Hard.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Because, well, it's hard to understand, but because if you look at the academic book reviews, not to give everyone a pass, but in terms of looking at the language, it's almost in code. I mean, you really have to spend some time studying, to really kind of decipher the code. Once you unlock the code and you realize what these people were about, and of course, one other point I would like to make about her own research, we did find out by chance that she spent some time doing some research in the old Soviet Union, and in terms of researching that period of scholarly research, I was really struck anew by the extent to which American scholars going to the Soviet Union had to tailor their research and their scope of study to get the approval of the Soviet government. Mm-hmm. So in other words, they were already under Soviet discipline when they arrived and began to do their study. And indeed, according to accounts of the time, if you deviated, you were barred from the archive. And so this became the exchange, archival access in exchange for essentially Soviet control over what you wrote. And whether these people were fully cognizant of this, whether they were already emotionally and politically in tune, that becomes a question for individuals. But the fact is, you did not enter those archives unless you were already with the program. And that is another attribute we can look at and try to evaluate regarding Nellie Orr and her research and academic career.
Right, and what she had to do with Fusion GPS, which is disturbing.
Yes, dialing the timeline forward, it becomes very disturbing. Do you want your anti-Trump coup being planned by people who will essentially rationalize Stalin's collectivization?
Wow.
I mean, this is someone who believes that government can do anything to get to that utopian place of equality or redistribution or whatever the mania is. This is the mindset. And again, it's not unique to her. It's part of a whole panoply of now American scholarship that has been teaching us and our children for many, many years. But it is shocking when you connect it politically to what we're learning about this fusion governmental effort to essentially upgrade opposition research that has a very strong Kremlin pedigree itself in terms of being disinformation. We can make that case pretty clearly. And upgrading that mess and malign mess into a trigger for police state surveillance of political opposition. I mean, this is how scary it is, and this is why the provenance is very important, especially when we throw in that cute little detail that has not been elaborated on, which is that Nellie Orr applied for a ham radio operator license.
Bizarre. Yeah.
At the time she was working for Fusion. Well, it is bizarre, but in the old days, if you talk to a old cold warrior, their ears prick up, and they remember the days when that was a very common sign that you might be looking at espionage, because people used ham radio to communicate outside, surveillance friendly channels, if you will. And is that what's going on? Maybe she's just an enthusiast for ham radio. But, it's a weird coincidence. It's just weird. So these are the kinds of questions that, yes, we should find out if actually she really just loves ham radio.
Right.
So, it's a question.
I'm guessing it's might be more than a hobby. So, looking at her background, right? Well, I wanted to talk about for a moment here someone that has a connection to Nellie Orr, Edward Baumgarten,
Yes.
He seems to have been a student of Nellie Orr. Am I correct?
Well, he was at Vassar, taking a degree in Russian history. At the time, Nellie Orr was a Russian history professor at Vassar, which is a fairly small liberal arts college. So I figure there's a very good chance that they knew each other, if they did not indeed have any, closer working relationship. Edward Baumgartner does seem to have been the eyes and ears on the ground in Russia for the fusion operation in with overlap on the dossier and their other big case, Russia case of 2016, which had to do with this Prevazone case that ties into the Russian Sanctions Act known as the Magnitsky Act. And they were doing research on that and support on that law case and also the dossier at the same time. And Baumgartner is involved in both of these projects. So he's a Russian speaker. He very well might have been a student of Nelly, or he may have been a protege even, but he is at Fusion at the same time she is, and that is another interesting piece of the puzzle that, again, needs to be really nailed down.
But
he also is a very nasty piece of work.
I was just going to say that.
Twitter account.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. He's a vile man, very disrespectful.
Yes.
I saw how he tweeted back or responded to Sarah Sanders, Dennis Prager. I mean, the guy is just vile.
Yes. Well, we do live in a vile culture and he does reflect that. But yes, it is kind of shocking because he is supposed to be a professional and have a business and this and that. So, and he has a Harvard master's in some kind of Russian studies degree. So, you know, you do expect a more civil tongue, but no, you don't find that. And it also is very interesting. He talks about, you know, these are just tweets, but he talks about purging people, Republicans. And he talks also about this notion that Dennis Prager misunderstands Russia, and it's sort of it's a lot to assign to a tweet. And I will commend your listeners to reading what I actually tried to tease out of this, because it's a bit hard to convey in a conversation. But very interesting kinds of people to be associated with what I think is a really important point to get across: the dossier as Russian disinformation. And this is something that's really bothered me, because even as we're watching the mechanics of the dossier come forth and be exposed, I think it's really important to get back to basics, which is the idea that when information comes out of Russia, comes out of Moscow, a good rule of thumb, and I write about this as well in the series, if the material has not been intercepted by the KGB, if the information is being gathered without understanding of Russian intelligence, then you might have something that, of course, you need to verify your sources and understand your context in these other matters. But when you're looking at an operation that was operating in and around Moscow for months, the GPS fusion operation, whether it was doing their legal work for the Magnitsky-related lawsuit, the Prevazone lawsuit, or the GPS fusion dossier, it seems next to impossible to imagine that Russian intelligence is not onto their efforts and indeed has not inserted themselves into their information flow. If that is the case, and I think it's only logical to at least assume it in order to test it, if that is the case, you are looking at Kremlin disinformation from top to bottom in the Fusion GPS dossier. Almost all Russian sources, very much of it is secondhand and hearsay. It is being repeated. It also turns out to be very much written in awkward, non-natural English-speaking diction, which is another issue. But it is all but certainly prepared with the knowledge, at least in part, of Russian intelligence. So the whole dossier itself is not trustworthy. It staggers the imagination to imagine all manner of intelligence and counterintelligence professionals treating it seriously and not subjecting it to this kind of basically ridicule in terms of how do you expect us to change the workings of government, to initiate surveillance, to run all through all these hoops based in some very large part on this dossier out of Moscow. I cannot believe that honest and responsible and minimally proficient intelligence professionals are doing this just based on these rules of thumb. And it's something that has not really been discussed in terms of how you evaluate intelligence. And it's all very well for us who are not professional, you know, not to understand, but to But given the number of professionals there are, and given that this has not been a matter of discussion, is another one of these massive failures, and it really needs to be kind of thought through again in terms of what are we actually looking at, aside from how it was weaponized and deployed inside the government.
Right, so that's even separate from it, but it doesn't seem to be that any, it doesn't seem to me that anyone's really looking at it from your perspective. The fact that you're even looking at this, it's, which is disturbing, since they're supposed to be doing this, not a citizen.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I have to say this before we finish here. Doesn't it bother you that a defender of Stalin would have, because she had done work with the CIA, and that her husband works for the Department of Justice, doesn't that bother you? And shouldn't it bother others?
Yes, it really should. I don't think that she's unique, as I indicate, in terms, certainly in academia, but also in the CIA. I mean, and we don't know exactly the nature of her connection to the CIA, but she does have an affiliation at least several years ago. Yes, I mean, and this would be, you know, an apologist for Stalin in my book is someone who wrings their hands over the loss and human loss and soft pedals it, and yet sees good in the end, or wonders if there's good in the end. And this would characterize her writing. She talks about, she writes about the, quote, agonizing paradoxes of the Stalin era and so on. And, you know, this does amount to a rationalization of the crimes against humanity, which so many on the left have always tried to separate from communism itself. Yeah. And I think that that, in, you know, becomes very dangerous. Yes, somebody inside our government, somebody inside having the kind of power that Fusion GPS was able to exert, you know, we don't even know their full extent of their relationship with the FBI and the unmasking process. There's all manner of evidence that this, they were part of that process too. Mm-hmm. So much more needs to come out. I think we're making progress, but it's really just the beginning. And certainly the allegiances and political perspectives of these players becomes central to understanding what was really going on. And I would just finish by saying that I think that Donald Trump, whether he knows it or anyone else knows it, is really the most anti-communist president, instinctively speaking, that we have had certainly for decades. This becomes important, too, when you are looking at Russian-linked, Kremlin-linked efforts to destroy him. And I think that we have to start remembering the patterns that we used to understand better and used to at least factor in as threats, and get back to understanding what I'm calling the red threads, because we know they're here. We know what our campuses are like. We know what our politics is like. We know what the world is like. And this has to come back to our understanding of strategy and survival, because right now, when you just have a blank slate, you cannot make any good decisions. Yeah. And that's why it's so important to try to reintroduce and follow wherever these red threads lead.
Absolutely. And as you said, I think we're at least heading now, beginning, but heading in the right direction. So listeners, I really encourage you to follow this series, which leads me to the question, where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books, including American Betrayal?
Thank you. Yes, this would all be at dianawest.net. I'm keeping it all there at the moment. So the entire series right now, I'm up to part 5, and part 6 is in the hopper, and it's just coming out. So I feel like the thread is long and quite strong, so I'm just following it. And my website also has the information of, you know, all the Amazon links for my books. And I will make the world premiere announcement that very soon I will have the audio book for American Betrayal ready for sale. I'm very excited about that. I recorded it myself.
Excellent.
And it also includes some new, never-before-published material. So I'm very excited about that, and I will let you know when that is totally finalized.
Excellent. I can't wait for that. And, of course, I will have those links in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the On Air button, and right under the show description, you'll find all the links that Diana just shared. Thanks so much again, Diana, for sharing your brilliant assessments with us. We look forward to your return to the show. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.
Bye-bye, Audrey.